Jennifer Grosvenor.
I'm John Grosvenor.
And we'll be sharing with you information. A significant amount of it is from the Lutheran Church in America. And the materials you see around the fire pit here are from the ESCA nationally and a little bit from some Israeli justice groups. Please feel free to take these home with you and to share. We sometimes get the question, how do we become involved in this? We are not faculty members of any academia.
I'm a banker. And my coworkers think I've lost my marbles and that I've been brainwashed by Palestinians.
And I'm actually a lifelong Lutheran. And a couple years ago, John said, you know, I think we're not getting the whole truth about what's going on over there. And he had an interesting way over there. And I said, you know, I wasn't going to plan that trip. But I said I wouldn't go as a tourist. I wanted to go to learn, be with the people, study. And so one of the nonprofit groups that I thought maybe had something was Lutheran World Relief. I heard they had study visits. And sure enough, they were the only organization that did it at the time. And so we were kind of on the fence, off the fence, whether we were going to go or not. And about a year and a half ago, we decided we would go. And having made that commitment, we were already doing a lot of reading and studying to get ready and listening to any speakers we could locally. We're from Portland, Oregon. And by the way, I'm a former teacher and consultant, and we've done a lot of community advocacy and volunteer work around homelessness and abuse. And so Lutheran World Relief had a trip planned for April 2002. And we were quiet about our interest. We didn't tell anybody about it. And about a month before the trip, we got the packet for the trip, and it said, now here's the bulletin insert for your church, and to collect school and art supplies. And with kind of timidity, I went forward and we put something in the bulletin. But by the time we went to print, the Israeli military had its first incursion into Bethlehem, where our hosting organization, the Lutheran Palestinians there, who Pope were to be our host, they went under curfew, which is a nice name for house arrest. So the trip was on again, off again, it went back on, it kept morphing into another type of trip. Ultimately, we had shifted it to a solidarity visit, and then 4 days before we were to go in, we learned that the IDF had a second incursion into Bethlehem, and the trip was canceled. But because we knew of Bethlehem Christmas Lutheran Church, and we knew their website for their school and the organization they call the International Center of Bethlehem, we could go in daily, hourly, and check their website, find out what was happening. So they were posting pictures, they were giving staff accounts, and the Palestinian Lutherans, as well as Lutheran missionaries who were over there, were logging such reports. They were hair-raising to us because what we were reading in the media gave us no idea of what was really happening on the ground. So we're here to share some of what we have learned in our intense more than a year and a half of study. And John's been over there twice now. I was over there with him last spring. And if you are interested in going, Lutheran World Relief is having another group go, and it's going to be, our trip never went, actually, in December, but we found out that a group called Sabeel got their group in, and we learned that they were based locally in Portland. It's an international organization, but the North America supporting group of Palestinian indigenous Christians, that their trip was going. So we went with them this last spring. Their brochures for Sabeel is here. It's for the voices of Palestinian Christians, and that includes the 3,000 Palestinian Lutherans who were there. So I will briefly also tell you that more and more is trying to be get out before Lutherans. All of this is ELCA materials, except for a little bit from Israeli justice organizations. The ELCA has a Middle East networking website. This is the home page. If you pull it up, I've got that copied. It'll show you links. It'll tell you what's going on. And if you want to sign up for the listserv, this tells you how. It also tells you here. Ann Hafton staffs that nationally. And you can then get about once a week. You might might receive information. It'll tell you what you're not hearing and give you some glimpses and some links into what you may not be hearing.
We should probably mention that the hosting organization, Sabeel, is based in East Jerusalem, and it was founded by Reverend Naeem Atik, who is an Anglican priest, and he preaches a non-violent resistance to the occupation.
And Palestinian Lutherans, in particular, are trying to get information out to other Lutherans, but also worldwide. And Bishop Yunan, he is the bishop for the Lutheran Church. It's said in Jordan, but it's actually the displaced Palestinian, because there's so many refugees, but also the Palestinian churches that are in the West Bank. And he has just written a book, Witnessing for Peace in Jerusalem and the World, and Augsburg Portress just has a new book coming out now by Anne Hafton, titled Water from the Rock, Lutheran Voices in Palestine. So we commend those to you. If you're in the region of Portland, if you're interested in this issue, we have a conference coming up where Naeem Atik will be speaking, and Hafton will be doing a workshop. An American, a Jewish woman, very active on end the illegal occupation of Palestine. She, Phyllis Venice, she will be one of our speakers. We will have Jeff Halper, an Israeli Justice Organization group director, who focuses on the house demolitions, but has been tracking so much of what has been happening and what he calls the matrix of control. He will be one of our guest speakers also. Conference brochures are here, and I just got word right before we left that the National Church, the ELCA, is a co-sponsor of this conference. So I commend this to you. If you have anybody in your churches or your network of contacts that you think are interested, I invite you to take a brochure home and share it. And it's available on the website.
When's the conference?
Oh, the conference. I'm sorry. It's August 29th and 30th. It's a day and a half, and if you can only come for one day, there's single-day options. What John and I'd like to do, because our PowerPoint presentation is available to be projected, because the projector's out of the village, is to show you a short clip from a movie that we'll show in its entirety. It's a documentary by an award-winning British journalist. In fact, you may have seen a clip. He's in Iraq right now. John Pilger, and his movie is titled Palestine is Still the Issue. We'll show it in its entirety 1 hour on Thursday night. These are a few outtakes. It'll last just under 6 minutes. If you can't see and you think the lines or lights in the
opinion, that Israel colonizing never stops. This looks like a medieval fortress. The Israelis call it a Jewish settlement. In fact, it's part of a network of armed colonies that, by one estimate, effectively control 42% of the occupied West Bank. Many of them dominate and intimidate Palestinian communities. They are illegal under international law and have been condemned by the United Nations.
When I came to West Bank, I saw all these settlements, Israeli settlements, on the tops of the hill, you know, surrounding all the cities, and you feel that they are over you, they are superior. And you are the ant, the insect stuff, you know? And you know this is your land, it's not this earth land, this is our land. But still, they are the ones who are on the top, and they have all the weapons, and they control also everything in the West Bank.
Inside the settler's fortress, it's a surreal middle-class suburb, dropped into one of the most overcrowded and poorest corners of the world. One of the strategic aims here is the control of water, which is precious in the Middle East. While Palestinians often don't have enough running water, sometimes none at all in the heat of summer, the settlers seldom run out. And the symbol of the occupation is this wall.
The thing that is striking about this settlement is that it's like a fortress. I mean, this is like a Berlin Wall.
On the other side of the wall is the reality of Palestine. At yet another checkpoint, people are waiting and waiting.
This is Rafet, your journey from Gaza to Khayyoun. This normal journey usually takes 20 minutes to reach from Gaza town to Khayyoun. But after this checkpoint, this journey sometimes takes people from 4 to 9 hours. People, as you see here, waiting to book from Gaza to Khayyoun. To guarantee the security of the passage of 2 or 3 prisoners.
So the security will drive along here. In the meantime, all this traffic has to bank up.
Exactly.
How long will these people be here, do you think? Just at a guess.
These people, they will stay till tomorrow morning because the road is closed now. It will not be reopened until tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Dr. Elfrar's family used to own land near this crossing. The Israelis confiscated it and demolished the home. And this is typical of what happens almost every day in occupied Palestine.
They demolished my house and another 26 houses the same night. I call it terrorism. Here I call it terrorism.
How long had your family lived there?
Maybe back to 900 years. We were in the same place. I feel angry. I feel devastated. I feel abandoned by the world. I think that nobody is taking care of us.
The half-built buildings of Gaza are a testament to the hopes raised, then dashed, by the talk of an independent Palestine. Without Israeli permission, most people can't leave and they can't return. They can't get the jobs. Their produce can't get the market. Most struggle to live on about £1 a day. A poverty compounded by an Israeli policy called closure.
You see, for Israel to sustain this unsustainable occupation, it is transforming every city and every Palestinian town and village into a prison, basically, surrounded by tanks, surrounded by walls, surrounded by fences. And it's not like they're building a border between us and Israel. It's building borders inside West Bank and Gaza, between our cities and towns for the sake of their settlements. They are obliging us to be occupied people and not citizens.
In July 2000, the two sides met in America to reach a final agreement. But among the issues they discussed was a profound disagreement about just how much land was on offer. Israel's Prime Minister at the time, Ehud Barak, claimed he'd offered the Palestinians almost all the occupied territories back and said that Arafat had rejected this. In reality, the Israelis were expanding more and more illegal settlements on Palestinian land, even during the negotiations. Add to that the special access roads with their checkpoints, and the Palestinians say that all that was left was a group of colonies with their borders patrolled by military bases.
Hello there again.
In the West Bank last October and then went back in March, April with her, and both of those trips were hosted by Sabil. When I came back, I had a whole lot of mixture of emotions, some despair and some anger and sadness, but also inspiration and a strong commitment to do whatever I could do to try to end this occupation. We have a lot of photographs that Jennifer mentioned is on a PowerPoint, which we don't have access to here. So I'm just going to go through two or three places that we visited. I'm going to give you some visual images, and you can just kind of imagine what these places look like. I'm sorry, we don't have the photos here. The first one I want to talk about is Hebron. In Hebron, which is a city down there in the south of Jerusalem. Yeah. It was a once thriving city of 130,000 Palestinians. I mean, it still has 130,000 Palestinians there, but it's no longer thriving. 400 Jewish settlers went into the downtown area, the central part of the town, confiscated the upstairs apartments, and just said, this is Jewish now. Those 400 settlers are protected by 4,000 Israeli troops who roam the city. They have set up sniper posts on the tops of 42 of the buildings in town. The Arab shops are all closed. Both times that we visited there, that I visited there, they were all closed. And on the doors, the shop doors are double metal doors, and almost all of them were spray painted with the most vile, most anti-Arab, racist graffiti imaginable, in both Hebrew and English. There's a large number of the Hebron settlers are U.S. Folks that have moved from Boston and Brooklyn and choose to live there. Basically, they've turned the city into a giant prison camp. We had to walk around in the city because the roads in the inner city are not open to Palestinians. The only roads that were open were those that only settlers would be able to use. And a Palestinian that would step foot on those roads could risk being shot. There hasn't been a building permit issued to a Palestinian in Hebron in 35 years. Okay. A week before we arrived last October there, the settler women had gone on a rampage, and the few Arab shops that were open, they had gone in and destroyed the merchandise while the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers, watched and just did nothing. The buildings in Hebron are where the settlers have confiscated the apartments. Those buildings are very close together. They're in the old kind of quarter. And the Palestinians have strung chicken wire up overhead. They've attached it up to the buildings up overhead to catch the debris that the settlers who live up above throw down upon them. And I saw shoes and rubbish and stuff up there. And the Christian Peacemaker team that we met with told us that the chicken wire, unfortunately, is not very effective at catching urine and feces. And they said that was a very common event. I saw a Palestinian man lined up in the hot sun. They were, I don't know what the soldiers were doing with them. They were checking their IDs or they were going to take them to jail. Hebron looked like a Hollywood movie set for a World War II movie, and it was real, and it's just a really mean place. It's not a nice place to live if you happen to be Palestinian. When I got back from this trip, I met with a member of the press, and after talking with her and interviewing, she checked with her editor, and her editor said, you know, we can't put the information that I just shared with you in this newspaper. It's too inflammatory. By the way, Baruch Goldstein, he was the settler that massacred 29 praying Arabs in this city and wounded 150. After he did that, the Jewish residents, the settlers in Hebron, erected a shrine to his memory, and the soldiers placed all of the Palestinians under house arrest for 6 months, they said for their own protection. Let's move on to Bethlehem, where we met with Reverend Mitri Raheb. Mitri Rahev is the pastor, he's a Lutheran pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. It's located near the Church of the Nativity. He toured us through the church, and this was in October, about 6 months after the Israeli occupation forces had gone into this church and smashed almost all the windows, broken all the doors. They took sledgehammers and they broke the toilets, and they went inside the church and they took machine guns and shot up the inside just for the fun of it, and took jackhammers and jackhammer holes in the floor. I mean, they really went to some real sweat to do a number on this place. And there were no armed Palestinians inside that church. You know, the armed Palestinians were over there at the Church of the Nativity, and while the international focus and cameras were on that church, this is what was happening to a Lutheran church that was undefended. And Mitri Rahev, he said to us, he says, how do we preach hope in a context like this? And he said that as Christians, we try to convince the people that there's a life after death. In Palestine, we try to convince people that there's a life worth living before they die. I'll never forget those words. He also paraphrased Martin Luther when he said that even if I knew the world was coming to an end tomorrow, I would go out into the garden and plant an olive tree. And he is one of my heroes. They've rebuilt the church, and they have built adjacent to it a brand new International Center of Bethlehem, which will be an important training center and a civic center for the community. By the way, there are Palestinian Christians, and I mean, a lot of people are surprised when they hear that, but there's less than 2% now of the Palestinian population are Christian. It had been approximately 20% when the Israeli occupation began in 1967. Over the years, over the 36 years of occupation, the Christian families, because they have a little bit more means and tend to have a little bit more education, when their kids grow up, the kids say, I'm out of here. They can't get it. There's no jobs. They can't move. They can't leave Bethlehem to go find a job. And so they get their visa somehow and they get out of there. And as a result, only 2% now of the Palestinians are Christian. And it's estimated that within 20 years from now, there won't be a worshiping congregation left in the Holy Land of Christians. That the churches will just be museums. The last image I want to talk about is in the Dahesha refugee camp in right next to Bethlehem. It's a tough place. 11,000 people. Palestinians are living in an area no bigger than Holden Village. It's crammed, and the housing is really marginal. And our small group, we spent the afternoon with a family in their home, sipping mint tea, and their son, the oldest son, Khalid, is 14, and he was a quiet boy, and kind of shy, really good-looking kid, but we got him talking, and he ran back in another room, and he came back out, and he showed us an award that he had gotten for playing soccer, and he had a certificate that he had gotten for his academic achievements, so he's a good student. But the third thing he brought out was very disturbing. It was a photograph of his best friend, and I looked at it, and it was a 13, 14-year-old boy was laying there dead. The kid had been shot by an Israeli sniper. Khalid and his friend had gone off to school. After school, some of the kids got involved with some demonstration, and some of the kids threw some rocks at a tank. And Khalid's friend, who threw a rock at a tank, was shot by a sniper and killed. And anyway, after that happened, a couple weeks later, Khalid's parents found a photograph that they had taken of their son in his room. And on the back of the photo, he had written, he says, if I'm martyred, I want this photo of me to be on my martyr posters. By the way, that's a martyr poster right there. That little girl, she was in Bethlehem. She was killed by an ambush of Israeli gunmen. That's an unusual one because there's a cross there. She was a Christian, and she was just riding in a car that looked similar to a car that was occupied by a Hamas suspect. And so that's an actual poster. We plasticized it when we got back. If the Israelis caught us with that, there would have been some heavy-duty interrogations, believe me. It's illegal to have one of those anywhere in Israel. I guess that's about maybe, I mean, we have a lot more to add, but I think in the questions and things and...
What we hope to do is have time for question and answer and then for some comments too. But I'm going to first orient you a bit with the maps for information that, so people are more grounded in some of the realities. I would like to share a few quotes though with some of the people that we met with. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti was interviewed on this. You may have seen him interviewed on TV also. He's a very, an incredible Palestinian leader. And he said, he's a physician, and actually his master's degree from Stanford. And he says, you know, he uses the medical terms, and he says, the symptom, violence is the symptom. Occupation is the disease. Elias Shakur has written, there's a book called Blood Brothers, and The Other Side of Peace is a story of his biography. It's in our bookstore. He spoke with us in Nazareth, and he said, if you want peace and security, work for justice. And Jeff Halper, with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, he's an Israeli Jewish man, says, those who want peace are on the same side. And he says that what has been taking place for over 100 years now is the process of displacement of the indigenous Palestinian people. And this is done through a matrix of control, control of their land and their water, and a system of exclusivity where just Jewish citizens of Israel are have the rights and freedoms. That it's a democracy for if you are Israeli Jewish, but if you're an Israeli Arab, you're not called Palestinian, but you are, you do not have equal rights. There's a system of control if you're a citizen in Israel, and then you're under occupation if you're in the West Bank and Gaza. And this is a book that we would recommend very highly. Yes?
I don't think that's correct.
Pardon?
I don't think that's correct. If you are an Israeli citizen of Israel, you have full rights. If you're an occupied, that's the difference between being an occupied territory and being an Israeli citizen. I met the Chief Justice of the Islamic Court in Israel, who's a Palestinian, is a citizen of Israel. There's a difference between whether you're a citizen or not a citizen. And so there are Palestinians who are citizens of Israel and some who are not.
Yeah, we can talk about some fine points later, but there are 20 laws on the books that prohibit the Israeli Arabs who are within Israel from having access to equal access. We can pick that up a little bit later, but first let me show you the map of Israel so that you are, you know, have sort of an awareness here. So we've got the Mediterranean Sea here, the West Bank, and Gaza under UN international law is 22% of the original historic Palestine, and under international law is indicated that it should be for the Palestinian people. And a short interruption here.
What is this about Palestine? There never was a Palestine. What you're talking about with the West Bank, that was Jordan. That was not Palestine, it was Jordan.
Correct. The movie on Thursday will go into a depth of history.
Well, that's okay. I wanted to make that point because there is misinformation on both sides.
Yes.
You're purely showing just what is on one side, and obviously the ELCA has chosen to make their stand on that one side.
Part of the ELCA.
Well, Palestinians have lived in this area for 800 years, so regardless of what name we want to affix to it, I don't think that really, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of difference. These people can go back many generations.
And you can go back to the British Mandate, or you can go back to the Jordanian, but the Palestinian people have lived in this land. And if you look at your globes from earlier periods, my globe says Palestine that was produced at that time. Now, this is the West Bank here, and this is Gaza here blown up. Gaza's 25 miles long, about 4 miles wide. The green show where Israeli settlements are now that have taken area here, some of the most fertile areas with water there in Gaza. And there's four access roads that were mentioned in the film that cut off and bisect and prevent movement of the Palestinian people. This map was prepared by Beth Selim, whom we met with, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. They did in-depth research to identify where the Jewish settlements are in the West Bank. All settlements in West Bank and Gaza under international law are illegal. And because as an occupying power under international law, you're not to transfer your population onto the land. The Israeli settlements are the blues, as well as the light blue, so all of the light blue, and then the light yellow is a zone which Israel has not granted any of the Palestinians rights to build on their land. The very dark brown pretty much is the area where, under some of the administrative changes under the Oslo Agreement, as things that there was allowing some of the Palestinian self-rule to take place. These are among, if you look at the dark brown and the next tone up, there's about 300 areas that are ringed and have Israeli military control around them, so the Palestinians can't get from place to place. This distance, I think, is about 94 miles and about 25 or so miles. The Reverend Mitri Raheb, in the most recent issue of the Lutheran magazine, has noted that regarding the roadmap, that the question, supports the two-state solution, he said, if we have the whole West Bank and Gaza, it will work out. My problem with the roadmap is that they think of process. But if one suicide bombing happens, if settlers continue building in the West Bank, the process will stop. And Israel wants to keep the land but doesn't want to assume responsibility for the people who live there. Okay, I think we can open it up and we'll, you know, share some stories or information and respond to some of your questions.
There are several questions that I have because identifying with you because Ashrawi was supposed to speak to our ethnic group, and she couldn't come because of the difficulties. But a question regarding Washington: should Washington be given back to England or the Indians? Should California be given back to the Indians or Mexico? Or should Louisiana be given back to France or the Indians? Or New York given back to the Indians? It's the same thing. I mean, I'm really puzzled about that.
Well, that is an argument used. One analogy that we heard Michael Taurasi say is that it's sort of like you're negotiating over pizza. But the problem is the pizza's being eaten while you're negotiating. So in 1948, 55, you think of this as being the land. And this is a fight over the land, which has, of course, the water resources, too. So over 55% of what had been the historic homeland of the Palestinians went under a UN discussion, or the UN recommended that go to them. The Arabs, of course, the Palestinians weren't happy with that because they were by far the majority of the population. By 1948, what happened is that Israel then managed to get military control over the 78% of the historic Palestine. And this 22% is what is being talked about under the roadmap. This is the West Bank and Gaza. But in 1967, during that conflict, Israel occupied the land. They have military control over it. Under occupation, as I said earlier, you're not to transfer your citizens into occupied land. But with the settlements, as you can see with the maps, it is actually eaten up about over 40% of the West Bank and Gaza. and now there's the wall. I don't know if you've heard about the Newsweek magazine did do a good article about it, and it shows where the wall is cutting in to the West Bank. And we stood at the wall and saw the system of fences and the high wall and towers. We saw a little bit here. That wall is eating in even further into the Palestinian land and making it so that the Palestinian people can't get access to it. It's cutting them off from their water and their most fertile agricultural land. So this is, it is a conflict over land. And Sharon has basically said about 11% of what would be left of historic Palestine seems to be what he would be willing.
I want to add real quickly, you said that the Palestinians were happy with that division. But yet, in 1948, it was all of the Arab countries surrounding Israel that were involved in that war. And then after that war, which the Israelis won, then Jordan continued to support the Fatah movement, which continued to harass Israel at that particular time. So you had another war in 67, and that's when they took over the West Bank. Then he had another war in 73, and that's when Israel took over the Golan Heights to protect themselves and took over all the other Negev, which they gave had to give back to Egypt. But all of that was in protection of themselves. So you have to consider that. And in addition to that, you have to consider that in all of that period of time, the manifesto by the Palestinians has been, they do not recognize Israel as a state. They will not exercise recognize Israel as a state. They will never take, they said they will never take that out. And in addition to that, part of that is to destroy all of the Israelis. How can you negotiate with a group like that?
Books I would suggest you read. One is Deliberate Deceptions by Paul Finley, our ex-US senator. He dispels a lot of the myths that you are sharing. I'm
the
sorry
wars, there's no myth there.
Well, you'll just have to get a hold of his book and take a look.
Well, I read a lot of that history, and I read it on both sides, by the way.
I think that Charles Smith's book, History of the Palestinian Arab Conflict, is another book in which you'll get a lot more information about this.
What I want to say is that primarily there is a lot of misinformation on both sides, and we're just getting one side here. And the other thing that you failed to point out is the majority of the peace groups that are working in, Christian peace groups that are working in Israel, the great majority of them are Christian groups.
Yes.
that find themselves on the place of supporting Israel, not the Palestinians.
Yes,
that's just an interesting point.
Yeah.
But the reason for that is because they're far-right conservative Christians, and they would like the old Davidic kingdom to be reestablished.
Well, that's a red herring.
That's absolutely.
Whenever I hear far-right, that's always a red herring.
Well, whoever they are, they're advocating that Israel be allowed to reestablish itself in the old Davidic kingdom from across the Jordan, all up to Damascus and way down below. That is their program. And the Baptists down at Dallas Seminary was on Minnesota Public or National Radio TV, and he was expounding on that. And he said that we're about 26% of the population in America, and that is our position. And they and we are tying ourselves in with the Jewish rabbis. And so Bush is faced with the problem of the combination of the Christian far right that believes the whole thing should go back to Israel because that's where David ruled the thing, and the Jewish people who say it's ours.
A very close friend of mine, Dr. Don Miles, I don't mind mentioning the name in case any of you might know him, his son, Jonathan, has been in Israel for 14, 15 years. He has five children. Four of them were born there. He has lived in both Jerusalem and in the Gaza Strip. And he's been to the Gaza Strip for several years. And what he has a ministry there. What he does for in his ministry is he gets Palestinian children to Israeli doctors for heart surgery, because the Israeli doctors have the expertise to do it, and the Palestinians do not. He gets them there for free service.
Nice showcase.
What impact does that have?
Well, let me finish. He gets them, therefore, free service. They came to him one night and said, Jonathan, get your family up because you're targeted to be killed by the Palestinians. And here's the guy that's getting free service for Palestinian children.
I want to get back to this gentleman's question, if we could, about the rights of Israeli Arab citizens. When we were in Nazareth, we had dinner with a group of people from Nazareth, and they are all Israeli citizens. They are also Palestinian. I sat next to a gentleman, a Mr. Munib, who is a contractor, and I asked him how things were going. It was pretty slow. He said the price of land is pretty expensive, and there's not much of it left, and he doesn't get very much work being a Palestinian. He told me that he had owned 14 dunams of land in Upper Nazareth, which the Israelis call Nazareth Elite. This is a very expensive land. He owned it for 20 years. 4 years ago, they took it from him, and they offered him $1,500 per dunam. He rejected that offer. The land was immediately resold to a Jewish Israeli developer for $150,000 per dunam. He has taken Israel to court. He has spent over $30,000 in legal fees the last 4 years, and he's gotten no place. And the reason that land was taken away from him is that he is of Arab ancestry. That is his only sin. And I'm sorry, but if you do some of the reading we have, you're going to see that some of this stuff we're talking about is true, and the truth hurts.
I understand that, and I accept it, by the way. But for every anecdote that you give, I could give you a counter anecdote, and the anecdotes don't matter. It's the overall problem that needs to be settled.
Well, we sure agree with that. So,
any other comments or questions? I'll share a bit. This is an excellent book. I'd highly recommend you. We have a Jewish friend who just returned from a trip with academics. They heard her speech as a professor at Tel Aviv. And she spoke, and we picked up her book on Will's recommendation. And she writes here, as I've mentioned earlier in this text, the division of the country along the lines of the pre-1967 border would leave the Palestinians with 22% of their original land. That would be the West Bank and Gaza would be what they have left. They, meaning the Palestinians, accepted that division in 1998 and reconfirmed it in Oslo. Since Oslo, mainstream Palestinian society has given up on armed struggle and even on political struggle to regain that land, meaning the other 78%. They said, fine, you have it. Let's just have the 22%. For 7 years, the Palestinians kept waiting for Israel to carry out its pledge to return their 22% of the land. And during the wait, all the Palestinians would hear echoing from Israel and the West was that their sacrifice was still not enough. She does good documentation, yes.
My concern is what the ultimate message of this is. It seems to me that if one is interested in justice, one needs to find a way to find an accommodation that works for both sides. If we, in order for justice to be done in Ireland, you had to take into account the interests of both sides. It doesn't seem to me to advance the cause very much to have the very real problems that you've been citing, very real, of one side without any attempt to have some kind of conversation about what would be a just settlement that could accommodate the very real problems of both sides, because people are getting killed on both sides, there are snipers on both sides, there's bombings and you know, on one side and bulldozings on the other side. You can spend all day talking about the atrocities for either side, but as long as you're listing the atrocities on only one side, we're not getting anywhere towards justice. And so my question is, what is it that we should work for that could accomplish justice in this terribly conflicted, terribly tragic situation.
Before I think anyone can move towards a place of justice, one needs to have an awareness. And our media...
But then one needs an awareness of both sides.
Exactly. Our media has provided pretty much a lens which is one which the Israeli government and the Israeli military has promoted. And it is very difficult.
I don't think that's true.
It's been well documented, actually.
Well, have you listened to National Public Radio?
Very much so, yes. They're probably about your sources in America, probably about your best source. But if you go to British media, you would find much more balance.
You see, we're seeking justice. As Lutherans, we should be seeking mercy. Otherwise, we're all guilty. We talked about sin. We need mercy, not justice. And whether you're pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel, whatever you have, you seek justice. You don't see the real picture. The real picture is mercy.
I think what he was saying is that just peace is the only kind of lasting peace.
No,
it has to be
a merciful peace, yes, but not a just peace.
Okay.
Justice will not work.
But I
this
think
is
in,
better.
International
mercy is
law
better than justice.
Is very clear about justice with respect to this issue. I mean, it says that to occupy land, you know, is not legal. You just don't do that. You know, it's inadmissible to grab land as a result of warfare.
The state of Washington was an issue between England and the United States, and 40,000 Americans, I assume there were 80,000 because it was 40,000 rifles, and the English were only able to get maybe 20,000.
Can I interrupt? You're way out of context for that. I mean, that's hundreds of years ago, and we're talking about a here and now situation. I think it's apples and oranges. That's a ridiculous sort of point to make, I think.
Why is it a ridiculous point that the United States has land that it occupied by military force?
No, but why counter what's going on now with that? That's something, I mean, I don't condone that any more than the other, but
okay.
The point is...
Okay, then don't. If you don't condone it, then it's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he's trying to say, how can we address this and not address the other? And it's, we're talking about a time gap that's very, very different.
One of the realities that B'Tselem, the Israeli organization that we met with, who developed this map, shared with us, they wanted us to take it back and to share it with people. These are Israelis. And they said that when they showed it to this map to the Israeli negotiating committee, the Israelis negotiating for, you know, some sort of final settlement, they were shocked. They really hadn't seen the reality here.
They hadn't realized how much land they've stolen.
That's a bad
word.
Well, maybe, okay, borrow.
Or that they occupy and control.
Well,
and
the settlements have got to go.
The other aspect...
The settlements have got to go. That's a different question from what you're calling occupation.
The
settlements are one question, whether or not the West Bank is, you know, how that's determined is a different question. The settlement's got to go.
Here's the other thing we were told by that settlement, is that because we have the American passports, we could get into the West Bank and Gaza. Israeli citizens could not. They do not see the day-to-day realities of what's taking place under occupation. They live with the day-to-day reality of the fear that there'll be a suicide bomb. And so they're frightened because, you know, should I let my child go on the bus to go to school? That's a very human reality. And that's one you've probably read in your newspapers a lot, and you can identify with it. And I identify with that.
Which is
but
why
I
the
also
world is
identify there. With the situation that Palestinians would be in, where they don't even have the right to send their children to school because they're under, quote, curfew, which is a word tailored for Americans to think that means your kids have to be in by midnight. The reality of curfew is you can't leave your house. You can't leave it for anything. You're under house arrest. Now, the assistant to Bishop Yunon, the Lutheran bishop there, is a Sandra, let's see if I get her name here. No, Mary, a Pastor Mary Jensen, and she, shared in her email, which Ann Hafton put over the Lutheran listserv through the Middle East Networking, which is that purple sheet, And Mary Jensen shares an article by the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, who wrote an article for Haaretz, which is sort of like their New York Daily Times. It's a daily newspaper. And he wrote an opinion article. And the title for it was Clueless About the Occupation. And as some of you know, when Sharon actually said the word occupation, there was quite a ripple effect within Israeli society, because they've been told that they're administering the territories. So they're not going there, and if they're not a settler, they don't have a realization of what the impact is on the land. And Mr. Levy writes, and he's been writing for 30 years, I believe, on this issue, and traveling there. What does Sharon know about life under curfew in communities? And I would add, what Salem told us about everyday Israeli citizens that have been under siege for years? Mr. Levy asks in his article, what does he know about humiliation at checkpoints, or about people being forced to travel on gravel and mud roads at risk of their lives in order to get a woman in labor to a hospital, about life on the brink of starvation? 2 out of 3 Palestinians now receive UN food aid because they can't feed their families. About a demolished home, about children who see their parents beaten and humiliated in the middle of the night, about prisoners and detainees held without trial who haven't spoken to their families for more than 2 years, about dialysis patients who are unable to reach the hospital for treatment. And then Pastor Mary Jensen writes, the lack of Israeli knowledge of the people who live on, not floating above, the land in the West Bank and Gaza is shocking, because all this suffering and oppression is going on just a few kilometers away.
You know, we should have prefaced, I think, our forum by saying that, we met with a number of Jewish peace and justice organizations in Israel and the West Bank. We met with Committee Against House Demolition, Gush Shalom, Rabbis for Human Rights, Jews for Global Justice, B'Tselem, Women in Black. Those are all Jewish, Israeli peace and justice organizations. So, I think we are hearing the sides on this. It's just that not all the Israelis are on the side of Sharon, thankfully. Unfortunately, there's still a small minority.
And also, well, if freedom
not
is
a small minority, I'm afraid.
Yeah, they are. They're small.
And you can have, in our country, a freedom of speech, but that doesn't mean you have equal access. I can almost count on my hands a number of times that an article balances what is written or spoken by an Israeli military representative or an Israeli government representative, because I will know facts from the information I have direct online directly from these organizations that will, dispute, peace Americans or peace now Jewish communities. Go ahead.
The criticism that we heard of the occupation of Israel was the loudest, the most strident from these Jewish organizations in Israel.
Including yes. Rabbis for Human Rights.
Yes.
I think that you probably wouldn't have a lot of defense for what Israel has done in the occupied territories from many of the people in this room. But again, getting to some of the points that have been made, the bottom line is what are the long-term prospects? And I think I would hope all of us would agree as well that Israel has very legitimate concerns for their national security. I mean, 9/11 brought something to us that had not been brought to us before. And for whatever reason, that is something that Israelis do live with. And so I need to put that on the table, not in any way to excuse what is happening in the occupied territories. But my question is, you started to address it in terms of the Israelis from the sense of the politics in Israel. Barak maybe didn't offer enough, but he got thrown out, as I understand it. Maybe you can comment on that, because he offered too much. It was a big liability for him. At least what I had read, maybe that's the Western media. But from a Palestinian standpoint, What are the prospects there of leadership as well in both Israel and among the Palestinians, of leadership that really could bring peace, both Israelis and things are going to have to take a better turn than they did with Barak's so-called generous offer. Barak's offer said that there would be a 9% of the West Bank would be annexed by Israel. And that's where that 90% offer came in. That sounded pretty good. What we didn't get in our media was that 40 to 45% of the West Bank would be under complete Israeli control, and with no time limit on that. Israel would be in control of the Palestinian borders. They would control the water and the electricity. They would control the airspace. Palestinians would not have an army. There would be no removal of the major Israeli settlements. 370,000 of the 400,000 Israeli settlers would stay in place on confiscated Palestinian land. There would be no right of return of the refugees. That was just off the table. Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza would be divided up into four discontiguous areas, complete restricted, a complete restricted movement of goods. All this would have rendered the Palestinian state non-viable, indefensible, and perpetually under Israeli domination. It was a bad deal. And
this is one follow-up.
It's been given this, this
one follow-up, if I could, though. I mean, the concern I have that I'm just trying to express here is if Barak was basically thrown out for being too generous,
yes,
by the Israelis,
right?
And if you're suggesting that offer was woefully inadequate, what I'm hearing from you, quite frankly, is very little in terms of prospects for peace. If there's some message of hope here, I'm not hearing it, and that's my concern. And
yeah.
Because if it's that far apart, that doesn't give much cause for hope.
Yeah.
The prospects for peace are actually very low, as long as the U.S. military and financial support for Israel continues to support essentially the occupation within the Iraq war. Funding, there was an additional $10 billion allocated to Israel. And Israel's the only country in the world that we give foreign aid to. We give $5 billion a year, $3 billion directly, and $2 billion in kind for military aid. Well, all of it's really, most of it's military aid. It's the only country in the world we give the money up front and do not have any accountability as to how they use it. And Israel throws it all into a common pot.
Kind of like the Arab countries that we give money to in the same way.
Israel's an exception, totally. You can check the government office and account.
I just mean to say that you can't overlook the fact that the U.S. gives billions of dollars to Arab countries, again, without looking for any accountability for the use of that money.
And of course, if we're in any dialogues around, with other sessions going on this week, the questions will be, what are we really, what does this mean? If we're looking for, hope, if we're looking for justice, if we're looking for equity, if our foreign aid is going to support military.
Well, both of them agree. They want, both sides want total victory. And that's a real big problem for us. We should be discussing that. The agreement, they both agree and they want total victory. And as a Lutheran, it's a real problem for us to deal with that.
I encourage you to do more reading, because it is really a myth that the Palestinians want total victory. What Palestinians would like is that last 22%, the two slices of the 10 slices.
And the Israelis to be gone.
No.
Just asking them to please, what is under the UN international law, to please get out of this area. Just leave them the West Bank and Gaza.
But my concern is, and I know I'm talking a lot here, but they've shown that they can't be trusted in negotiations. You talked about they're not allowed to have an army. They were allowed to have a Palestinian police force that became an army. They were given approval to have an airstrip, an airport in the Gaza Strip, and they turned it into a place for shipping in ammunitions. So they've just shown that they've not been able to be, that they're not trustworthy in the negotiations. That's a problem. So again,
so they're supposed to remain completely defenseless. They're supposed to agree to remain completely defenseless while Israel has all the firepower and all the might and everything. So it's wrong for them to want to have a little bit of defense?
That wasn't the situation. The Palestinians turned their police force into an army that was being used against the Israelis offensively.
Israel
that's not
what is Israel
against the occupation.
Well, as I said,
again,
no, no, wasn't against the occupation.
Why should terrorism stop as long as land is occupied?
That's a bad question.
That's a true question. And that is what we have to settle. Yeah. General Sharon says when terrorism stops, then we will talk peace. The Palestinians say, when occupation stops, then we will stop the terrorism.
As Daryl says, it appears that the settlements need to go, but still that's not a defense. There's never, ever any defense for terrorism in any way,
of
ever.
Of course it is.
How would you like us to roll down your house? How would you like a big, huge machine come and just take all the houses down your neighborhood? Just get in there and pull them up. What would you do?
Several years ago, a very
the
good
Israelis
friend.
Are guilty of a lot more terrorism than the Palestinians.
And the more Americans they kill, the more the Americans are going to fight.
Several
back.
Years ago,
I mean,
a very good friend shared with me about a situation
in
Israel. I got to tell you this. This is from years ago. No one else.
First of all, I just want to close and say, you know, if because media has provided a perspective that many of you are aware of, what we shared tonight is probably shocking for some of you, but now that there's a lot more speaking out being done, a lot more publishing being done, I think you will find if you do reading that what we have shared is historical and current conditions. It is difficult land issue. It's 9:45. If you'd like to stay in dialogue with each other, ask us questions,
around.
We'll stick
Mary,
around.
Thank you.
Thank you.